webinar on COVID-19 and LNG markets and contracts. The webinar is hosted by the Department of Law at the London School of Economics, and thank you very much for taking the time to be here with us today. We have three excellent speakers on the panel, and I will now briefly introduce them in the order of their presentations. Jonathan Stern is Distinguished Research Fellow of the Natural Gas Program at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies and holds a number of honorary positions at various research centers across the globe, including as a professor at the Center for Energy Law and Policy at the University of Dundee. Our second speaker, who will join us shortly, Paul Griffin, is an English lawyer with four decades of experience in the leading deals and disputes in the international oil and gas business, who currently acts as an arbitrator, mediator, and expert in oil and gas matters, and is also an honorary professor in Dundee. Our third speaker, and Paul has joined us now, our third speaker, Kim Tallis, is director of Tulane Center for Energy Law, professor of law at various universities, including Tulane at the University of Eastern Finland, and the editor-in-chief of Ojo, a media partner for this event. Kim could luckily join us today, despite disruptions brought by the tropical storm in Louisiana, and hopefully he will be with us without interruptions until the end of this event. We are all, in fact, living in testing times, being exposed to disruptions of various kinds and seeking solutions. Our plan for today is to examine the impact of the current coronavirus pandemic on the LNG industry in order to formulate some recommendations for the future. We will start with the presentations from our speakers. Jonathan will discuss pricing mechanisms in LNG contracts. And then Paul will look into volume flexibility and Kim destination flexibility arrangements in LNG contracts. Then we will have a discussion and a Q&A session, and I encourage you to post your questions to the chat box and to start doing so at the during the presentations. The final introductory point will be to say that the webinar is recorded, and I will now hand over to Jonathan.
Agnieszka, thank you very much, and hello everybody, wherever you are and whatever time of day it is where you are. In relation to price mechanisms, when I give this lecture to students, I subtitle it The Long March to Economics 101. What do I mean by that? I mean that in most first year economics courses, the first lecture is about how the price of a product should be some combination of the supply and demand for the product in the market into which it is being sold. The gas industry never believed that from its beginnings, and it took around 30 years for that idea to take hold. In North America, that happened in the 1980s with deregulation. In Great Britain, it happened with the move from cost-related pricing to hub pricing in the 1990s. In continental Europe, it happened towards the end of the 2000s, beginning of the 2010s, in the move from oil-linked pricing to hubs. But Asian LNG contracts are the last leg in the long march to Economics 101. Asian LNG long-term contracts have tended to be linked to crude oil, and they've tended to be linked to what is called the Japan crude cocktail. This took hold from somewhere around the mid-1980s onwards, and of course, because 70% of global LNG is delivered to Asia, this is an extremely important part of the global gas and particularly the LNG story. Now, the idea of tying LNG prices to the prices of imported crude oil into Japan may seem quite strange unless you know a little bit of the history. And to make that relatively long story as short as I can, this is because initially LNG was imported into Japan for power generation. And if you know Japanese logistics, you'll know that a lot of Japanese power stations are on the coast, And a lot of them were using crude oil up until the 1970s and still in some cases today. So it made some sense to relate the price of LNG to the price of imported crude oils. However, that practice continued and indeed applied to countries other than Japan, strangely enough, so that the JCC pricing mechanism has lasted a very long time and has spread right throughout Asia. Now, a break then happened towards the early 2010s, when the shale gas revolution in North America, and particularly initially in the United States, gave rise to the start of US LNG export contracts being negotiated in the first half of the 2010s, and based on a Henry Hub Plus mechanism. So the idea was not that you based the price of LNG on crude oil, but you essentially took a Henry Hub price, you added a factor to that, and then the liquefaction cost and the shipping cost, and that gave you a kind of net forward price from Henry Hub. This, of course, made enormous sense in the early part of the 2010s when, as I will show you in a moment, the price of Henry Hub was very low and the oil link price of LNG in Asia was extremely high. As we shall see, that situation has changed quite considerably. But the lesson from this in terms of price formation is that most of the commercial protagonists were looking at price level rather than price formation. In other words, they were looking at the dynamics of Henry Hub, which is set by North American and US supply and demand. They were not looking at what that meant for supply and demand in the Pacific region. Now, around that time, there was a lot of discussion about whether Asian hubs could evolve. And this centered on Singapore, Tokyo, Shanghai, and more recently, Chongqing. It has to be said, again, cutting a long story relatively short, that these have not been a great success. The Singapore sling price has been discontinued. Tokyo has made no real progress. There has been progress in Shanghai and latterly Chongqing, but there are not big volumes, and there is a concern that those hubs may be too easily controlled by the state-owned Chinese majors. The key issue here in Asia is that there has been very little liberalization of gas markets. It's liberalization that moved gas prices in North America and Europe to hub-based or market-based pricing. And the key point here was that once all parties can get access to pipelines and LNG terminals, then they're able to penetrate the markets. And the owners of those facilities, who tend to be the large-scale incumbents, find themselves competing with new entrants. And since new entrants are keen to access low-priced spot gas, this starts to become very problematic for particularly incumbents who are locked into long-term oil link contracts. So the next part of the LNG story is the start and indeed enormous increase in short-term and spot LNG trade at spot and short-term prices. This has increased to 30% of total trade over the past few years. But for those of you who are more familiar with oil price terminology, spot and short-term trade in LNG speak means contracts of less than 4 years. Now, in many commodities, probably most commodities, you tend to find that spot trade indicates something much of a much shorter term. But this gave rise to the start of JKM pricing. And if I could have the price slide on now, please. What I'm hoping you're seeing on this slide is the development of regional prices over the past 10 years. There are four sets of regional prices. HH is Henry Hub. TTF is the Dutch title transfer facility, which is a reasonable approximation of European spot and hub prices. Japan average, which you see in the yellow at the top, is a reasonable approximation of the JCC price. And then you see the JKM price, which is this new Platts marker. And although it stands for Japan Korea marker, it is a price where LNG is swapped and traded in a certain number of lots, not a large number of lots, all over Asia. Now, as you will see, the explanation as to why US LNG was so popular in the early 2010s is you see that enormous spread between Henry Hub at the bottom and the Japan average price, the JCC price at the top. And then you see that as we got past 2016, which coincidentally was when US LNG started up, the actual export started up, the spreads start to narrow. 2019, 2020, the spreads close way before the COVID crisis. But you see that the oil link price remains much higher. So what's happened in to prices is not a direct result of COVID, as you could argue, for example, the oil price collapse was a direct result of COVID. The gas price collapse happened much earlier, but in fact, it has been accentuated by the COVID crisis. So let me start to draw this to a close as I see my time is getting short. If we try to answer the question of will the crisis cause a profound change in price formation mechanisms, we see no change in North America, see little change in Europe, except possibly in Southeast Europe and Turkey, where we're beginning to see significant additional quantities of LNG being sucked in because those regions are still, they're the last regions in Europe to be relatively strongly oil linked. But Asia is really what matters. And we think in our work in Oxford, we see the trend in crude oil linked to market pricing continuing. Hybrid pricing, which you'll hear used as a term in the industry, this is a kind of temporary compromise. And I'm not fond of hybrid pricing because what it means to me is, well, why don't we take a little bit of oil, a little bit of Henry Hub, a little bit of TTF, maybe a little bit of electricity, some fixed price, and we put them all together. And the hope there is, well, as long as nothing moves too far away from where it was when we negotiated it, it'll be fine. For me, that is only okay as long as you have a really good price review clause. And we might discuss that more when we get to the Q&A. What does this mean for the next immediate year or two? Well, it means that China and India will push for some kind of move towards spot prices, whether it's JKM or domestic benchmark, and some other issues which I think our other speakers will discuss. Exporters are going to face increasing demands for volume and price renegotiation if the contracts allow for it. And that starts to open up issues of litigation. But where we are in the supply, the LNG supply wave is, we've got a huge increase in uncommitted cargoes. In other words, cargoes which are not committed to long-term contracts. We've got around 50 million tons of long-term contracts expiring in the first half of the 2020s, and therefore having the opportunity to choose a new price mechanism if they're going to be continued. And for me, the key question is where the liberalization of markets accelerates in Asia. Why is this the key question? It's the key question because for as long as the big incumbents who import LNG can pass their costs through to their customers and their customers can't get access to any other gas, then essentially they're in reasonably good financial shape. The moment that changes, which was what happened in Europe, then they're in big trouble. But to finish, most of this was underway before COVID-19. So the crisis may have made this more urgent, but essentially this is a secular trend which I don't believe can be stopped. And with that, Agnieszka, I will pass back to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jonathan. And we will now move to Paul, who will discuss volume flexibility arrangements.
Hi. Agnieszka, I hope you can hear me.
I do.
Very good. And my apology for being late to arrive. I think Kim managed to make it through a hurricane, and I sat in a dull North London and couldn't make it. But your technical colleagues were very good, so thank you very much. And for the introduction. Jonathan has given a wonderful panorama of markets and prices there. And what I want to pick up is the area of volume flexibility. And this really sits before Kim comes on to destination flexibility. For me, and not just because I'm a lawyer, but one of the first things to do is to look at the relevant contracts. And in the same way that Jonathan mentioned the background of LNG pricing and price formation, LNG contracts have for many years developed their own way. That is changing very quickly, but when we're looking at volume flexibility, one of the first things to do is to really see what your contract is. Now, obviously, the best flexibility you can have is a spot contract for, say, one cargo, or if you're looking at pipelines, short term. But the LNG business has not been built in that way. And we're looking really at the scale of quantities under long-term contracts, 20, 25 years, through now to shorter terms, but still not short in most measures. There are market influences of things like auctions, where you see here different influences begin to take over. So as LNG has been the very opposite of the just-in-time mentality of delivering commodities in today's world, the two are coming closer together but are far from colliding yet. Within a typical contract, just run through a few of these, rights for both the seller and the buyer to adjust quantities. So here you have delivery quantity tolerances, abilities to move up and down. These tend to be fairly marginal. They're not going to make a big difference. There are also profiled quantities. When you have that long period of time, then parties will very often look to match over time how they see their markets and their quantities. Sometimes this will lead to financial adjustments as well. So all number of different mechanisms, largely dependent on alternative means of supply or alternative means of delivery. So here, I think what have come into play in the last 5 years or so, the opportunity for cancellations, closing out the intended delivery because there is a market available. And again, this is different. Pipeline gas is still slow to adapt. LNG has adapted much more quickly. Contractual flexibility just for the individual party, well, typically that's a contractual one for the buyer. And here, it's not so much a failure to take as the classic construction of a take or pay contract. A rare animal in many types of legal analysis, but very usual in gas. So a take or pay contract where the buyer can perform it in an alternative of ways, either taking or not taking and paying. Complex terms, typically associated with a right to make up. So for example, this is not sort of fatal consequence of having to pay without taking. It's often seen as an ability to defer on terms. And if you put take or pay contracts in the hands of traders, and particularly commodity businesses, then they are a very good trading opportunity. The financial consequences will change over time. Looking then on the other side of the equation, and the seller and the seller's failure to take, well, again, this will typically be provided for in the contract. So each of these contracts is largely self-contained. What the parties are looking to do is not leave themselves open to damages claims for failure to take or failure to deliver. It's managing that within the contract. And the classic failure to deliver provision is a shortfall provision. So they're an established remedy in the event that the seller fails to deliver. Quick look within the contract. Clearly what we're looking at today is also COVID and the way that things have shifted. And I think for much the same reasons as Jonathan mentioned, this is a trend which COVID has possibly exacerbated in certain ways, but a strong driver in any case for the move to flexibility. Pipeline and LNG I've mentioned, and available alternatives. I'd also mention, before we move on, the choice of law. These contracts are very complex, large, heavily negotiated, and the choice of law is a significant part of that. English law is a very usual choice. It's not the only one, but it has come to dominate. And English law is a common law which is towards the extreme of those common laws which enforce the bargain the parties have made. It is a regime which gives open ability, freedom of contract, to make the contract you choose. A corollary of that is you can choose to provide for reliefs for yourselves, but if you don't, then the law won't help you. Bit of an overstatement, but not far off, to say that if you have made a bad bargain which turns against you, then the courts and arbitrators will enforce that against you until you don't have any money left. With that happy thought, we'll just move then beyond the contract. Obviously, beyond the contract, lots of different ways of managing volume flexibility. One is storage, for example, certainly on a buyer's side. Storage has its own difficulties, particularly in Europe. Another is portfolio of contracts. And another within that portfolio is the move in recent times of the United States, and particularly United States exports into the rest of the world, working not on a commodity basis so much as a cost of liquefaction, cost of shipping. And as always with long-term contracts, the changes of circumstances are the most difficult things to address. So many of these contracts are structured on the basis that the US is the low-cost supplier of gas, LNG, in the world. And you only have to look at Jonathan's chart to see that in recent months, it's actually been above the price in Europe and nudging that in Asia. So cost plus contracts from the US fundamentally can't look good news at the moment, but that brings in cancellations. Another area to look at is beyond the contract is intentional failures. So here you see the impact of volume flexibilities and particularly traders. And here, if you are, particularly if you're a seller of LNG and you are under a longer term contract with a fixed price and that price is lower than the available market, then you may be tempted to not make that delivery and instead take advantage of the higher price in another market. Because, as I mentioned earlier on, the sanctions for failures to take tend to be contained within the contracts, there is an ascertainable remedy available to the buyer. But the seller's margin can be much more than that. So intentional failures have come in, terribly difficult to deal with under English law. Also, here, whether it's a failure to deliver or a failure to take, is an avoidance of even the limited remedies by claims for relief, classically force majeure. So here, this is a notion I mentioned earlier on, that English law is towards the extreme of common law regimes and those which will enforce the bargain the parties have made. There isn't a relief for hardship under English law. There is something called frustration, but it is very difficult to establish. So force majeure is not a notion which exists in itself, but it is typically defined within the contracts. Whereas many civil law regimes will identify force majeure and hardship as matters of application under the governing law, English law is different. Force majeure, and I suppose COVID has been really interesting here, where you see how many people are now declaring force majeure. The vocabulary is the wrong way round. Force majeure classically is a relief from liability for a failure. It's not for the suffering party to declare. They have to show it. They have to prove it. It's a matter of claiming. And I'll come on to some examples which muddy that, but I think it just shows how things are shifting at the moment. The test will be established in the contract, typically events beyond the control of the party having exercised reasonable steps to avoid the failure happening, and after it's happened, to remedy it. I think it's been particularly interesting in the COVID circumstances. The first time I came across COVID and force majeure was the construction yards close to Wuhan, where the government took the step of announcing that contracts were relieved by reason of force majeure. Big step on the part of a government to declare that. But for me, that was the first time I saw that happening. And also, in pushing volume flexibility beyond the contract, look at matters of termination. And here, sometimes long-term force majeure can result in rights of termination. So clearly the volume flexibility here is you want to be rid of that troublesome contract where the deliveries aren't being made or the price doesn't suit any longer, and join in with somebody else. Because each of these long-term contracts necessarily closes out other alternatives. And it's that balance of other alternatives and flexibility within the contract which has changed such a lot over the last 5 years or so. Also worth touching on price reopeners here and the relationship between volumes and prices. Price reopeners have tested many elements of English law and are continuing to do so. I think when you now look at the sort of new provisions, particularly for things like carbon and how to address carbon certification, changes of certification, there's quite a lot of familiarity to the unknown unknowns of price reviews and price assessments. Another is the matter of damages. So here again, with volume flexibility, if you can terminate one contract, typically because it's unfavorable, then what damages liability might there be and how are those assessed? And then just to finish up, some other considerations, and this really is within the contract and beyond, but I think within the context of our discussion, I hope it will be helpful to put these out. One is, gas contracts, pipeline or LNG, have many obligations of reasonable endeavours. Again, for many lawyers, these are quite unusual things, but it's because the parties can't predict the future. They can't, over the course of 5, 10, 15 years, predict the circumstances. Therefore, the parties are reluctant to take a firm obligation, because English law will hold their feet to that fire. So the obligation is reduced, meaningful but not absolute. These are relational contracts. And again, if you look at LNG markets moving only slowly, English law moves really slowly. But even English law is underway with relational contracts and how long-term cooperative contracts are subject to a separate assessment at times of difficulty, among others. Interesting initiative, but within the context of the LNG business or the pipeline gas business, these are, to me, classic relational contracts. Governments are now taking an interest. I mentioned the state of Wuhan, which declared force majeure for the benefit of constructors. In the UK, there has recently been publication by the government, because of COVID, telling parties how they should behave under the contracts, not enforcing rights, but being softer about things. Published as guidance, but an unusual step. I've not seen this before. There's also been a recent case concerning dispute resolution and the unavailability of cost recovery for a winning party when the winning party refused to enter into mediation. That's a big step. But again, in an environment where everybody is hurting, everybody is suffering, these are some steps which, to me, come back to our question of volume flexibility and how you might be able to escape the rigors of your contracts. I have my notes in front of me, Agnieszka, and then I'm going on to energy transition, greenhouse gases, lenders and governments, but that's maybe for the discussion.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Paul. And now we will listen to a presentation from Kim on destination flexibility, who will perhaps share some happy thoughts too on the subject.
Thank you. Well, yes, happy thoughts in the sense that volume flexibility or destination flexibility are somewhat connected in today's world. And destination flexibility is something that has been going on as a trend for many years now. I lived in Australia about, let's say 10 years ago, and I participated in one of their main industry events. And they were talking about long-term gas contracts. And right about that time, sort of 2010s, Europe was changing. And I told the audience before I started my presentation that the discussion here is exactly what we had in Europe about 5 years ago, when in particular Jonathan was talking about these things. The audience didn't really believe me and thought that this change will not take place here in decades, but it didn't take that long for things to change. And one of the things we see changing is the destination flexibility. And so this, already before COVID-19, has been a trend in LNG markets. We see increasing flexibility in terms of destination from shorter term contracts, free on board contracts. We see even equity participation in upstream projects. And then obviously buyers just asking for more flexible terms in their contracts. Now, the impact of COVID-19 in simple terms has made destination flexibility that much more important. Now, buyers don't want, or in some cases, they cannot take cargoes that they've ordered. And in addition to claiming force majeure or other contractual rights, what they can do, if allowed under the contract, is to move the cargo elsewhere. And we see this happening in terms of European cargoes or cargoes going to Europe being diverted to Asia. We see cargoes going to China being diverted to India or Singapore, and so on and so forth. So we see this diversion taking place on the back of COVID-19, probably also because of the mild winter in the northern parts of the world. This was already happening before, as Jonathan was saying. So simply said, destination flexibility should be natural, to me, should be natural and normal in a well-functioning and liquid market, as we are starting to see in LNG. So why are we even talking about flexibility and destination flexibility in this context? Well, as Jonathan already noted, traditionally, pipeline gas and LNG was traded on the back of these very rigid long-term contracts. There was very limited short-term contracting and even less so or no spot trading, except for the US. So trade was really point-to-point trade between a producer-seller and then a utility buyer. The numbers were very, very low. And so essentially an LNG trade was a bit like a pipeline trade from end to end. And in this type of world, these rigid contracts made a certain amount of sense because they brought a lot of certainty to all players, making significant upfront investments. But today, the markets are very different. And this is why we see more and more flexibility in terms of destination. We have an increasing number of sellers and buyers. We have new opportunities for sales. We have new kinds of players in terms of traders, and so on and so forth. In this type of world, these destination clauses that I'll explain in a second, profit sharing clauses and alike, clauses preventing diversion of cargoes make very little sense, at least to me. To me, why would the original seller have anything to do with what the buyer does with its product that it already bought and paid for? It should be, to me, up to the buyer to decide that, unless there are very specific reasons and effects to the original seller. But as said, we see that destination clauses and all kinds of profit sharing clauses are slowly fading away. Here, the entry of the US has been one significant factor because US LNG is sold mostly on free and board basis, a lot through a tolling model and with very, very few destination restrictions. So that has created pressure for good reasons on other sellers as well. But before I talk about those clauses, one thing that I need to stress is that long-term contracts in gas in themselves do not necessarily prevent liquidity or emergence of spot markets. That specific clauses in these contracts that have that type of effect, destination clauses are a group of these, or one of these type of clauses, and then the cumulative effect of all long-term contracts. So what is the number of long-term contracts? What volumes from the total volumes of the markets do they cover? These are the type of issues that can then prevent, let's say, market liquidity, but not a long-term contract in itself. So what do I mean when I'm talking about destination flexibility? So a buyer of, okay, I have a text coming. Okay, that's a comment. Okay, that's fine. We'll have a look at those at the end when we have Q&A. So I'll go back. Traditional LNG contracts have certain clauses that prevent the buyer for either rediverting or diverting the cargo somewhere else or reselling the cargo without taking it themselves. Now, from a buyer's perspective, in order to optimize their downstream business, it might make sense that they take a cargo at a different location. They might need it more there, or they don't need it at all at one location, or maybe cannot take it because of COVID-19 labor force restrictions or something similar. It might also make sense to sell the cargo without taking it, diverting it to a different type of market or different hub or something similar. Now, that's usually how markets work. You make money from price arbitrage, you take the cargoes, your products where you need them. But with LNG contracts, there are certain traditional clauses that prevent that from happening. In a straightforward destination clause, the buyer have to take the cargo at a specific location. They cannot re-divert. Okay, I'm sorry. I have a. Okay, I had some sort of update coming on my screen. Sorry about that. So you cannot divert the cargo anywhere. You take it where the where it's contractually nominated to come. In a consent clause, it has a similar effect, except that you have to ask for the consent from the original seller to divert the cargo. If you have a profit sharing clause, you need the consent. And then if you make additional profit, part of that profit will go to the original seller. To me, that makes no sense whatsoever. I do know that if I talk with energy lawyers, some of them would strongly disagree with me, but that's nevertheless my opinion. But as said, we see that markets are moving away from that type of those type of contractual clauses. And what are the reasons for it? One is just to me, a natural consequence of changing markets. With more opportunities, more liquidity, that rigid structure no longer serves the purpose, and buyers want to be able to shop around because there are now options. You have a lot of an increasing number of producer sellers, you have traders, you have spot markets. But then, on the other hand, the liberalization of many markets and a lot of the countries, not only Asia, but also elsewhere, have either liberalized or are looking for some kind of liberalization measure to take place at some point that provides opportunities to resell. And the emergence of hubs contributes to the same. With liberalization, third-party access allows you to enter the markets, sell at a hub, or sell to a customer. And that creates an incentive to start re-diverting. Without that option, it doesn't make much sense to try to de-divert because you can't sell it anywhere unless you need it yourself for a different reason. But then, to me, one maybe a smaller element, but in practice that can be important, is that reloading of cargoes. So taking the cargo, reloading it, put it into another tanker to a different location, has become more easily or readily available and cheaper because you have regasification terminals that can reload cargoes coming up all around. Just look at Europe. They have been popping up everywhere. The utilization rates have traditionally been very, very low. So reloading is not that expensive, and therefore, and it's very difficult to control from the original seller. So it might not make sense to have very strict destination clauses when they can be circumvented relatively easily. Finally, a last reason for this trend, certainly not today the driving trend, which is more the question of being a buyer's market. I'll talk about that in a second. But also the guidance from antitrust authorities in terms of destination and profit sharing clauses is a significant issue. And here, two large buyer markets, EU and Japan, have both looked at destination and all kinds of diversion clauses and have approached them relatively similarly, although there are differences, but in both cases, a restrictive view on these issues. Europe looked at these in the early 2000s already with pipeline gas. They looked at this issue from an internal EU market and free trade within EU perspective. Those were decided back in early 2000s, but now we see from more recent cases that issue has not completely, it's not gone from Europe either. But in 2017, the Japanese antitrust authorities looked at the same issue, but from a global liquid LNG market perspective. So a kind of a different perspective, but came out with similar guidance, no doubt in cooperation somehow with the EU authorities. Both authorities have made a distinction between free on board and delivery at ship trading. And both authorities see that FOB on free on board terms, in these shipments, all kinds of restrictive diversion clauses are problematic from antitrust perspective. From delivery ship or DES contract mode, you do need a contractual delivery point. And here you can see that the views of the two authorities differ a little bit. It's too bad that we haven't seen the latest EU case, the Qatar LNG, coming to a conclusion, because my hunch would be that that case would have brought the EU approach closer to the Japanese approach, or at least a more nuanced approach, because today the EU approach has been that in a delivery ship, a profit sharing mechanism is possible as long as it's clear, it's not too one-sided, because in the EU approach, the agreement to redivert the cargo somewhere means that we are talking about a new contract and new terms are possible. To me, that's a bit structural or formalistic distinction and view. The Japanese have taken a more restrictive approach, and they require that the diversion is always possible, except for certain very restrictive reasons. And profit sharing requirements are possible, but only to the extent that they are clear and they're based on additional costs and risks taken by the original seller, which means they're not really profit sharing clauses. They're just a way to deal with additional costs and risks. Now, back in 2008, I was involved as the lead author in an effort sponsored by European Commission and Japanese Ministry for Trade and Industry, or Economy, Trade and Industry, where we created a model diversion clause, model profit sharing clause, that would be antitrust compatible, both in EU and in Japan. And here we obviously are closer to Japanese requirements because they're more restrictive, but we came up with a clause that would allow rediversion, except for very, very few reasons. And the seller cannot object very easily and prevent. And it uses profit sharing only to compensate for additional risks and costs. There are a lot of more details. I won't go into them. It's available on OGL website. But to me, that model clause and this antitrust guidance might not be that important today, right now, because of the buyer's market, because we have a lower demand. We already had before COVID-19 because of the warm winters, but COVID-19 has made this much more clear. It's a buyer's market at the moment, and when buyers are now negotiating new contracts or are visiting existing contracts when a price review, for example, under the contract or even outside the contract becomes relevant, the buyers today can probably muscle in a more flexible destination clause in the contract itself. COVID-19 has made these rediversions of the cargoes much more important and just sensible. So perhaps I just leave it at that. I'll close by saying that if that's the situation today, when we move back to a seller's market, and that might happen at some point, of course, and it probably will happen at some point in time, then we need the antitrust guidance, because then we're going to see demand for more restrictive seller-friendly contracts emerging again. So that's when our model clause becomes necessary. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kim. And thank you to all of you for your very insightful presentations. The common leap theme could be perhaps that the COVID crisis has identified or highlighted several areas for improvement in relation to the key terms in LNG contracts. Before we move to the questions from the audience, and I encourage you to post the questions in the chat box, and this concludes the recorded part of our webinar, let me perhaps ask you a question that ties